coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. The state's Downtown Development District program is expanding, hoping to build on its initial effort to revitalize downtowns across Delaware.
In the 4 years that the program has been going so far, the state has provided $31.6 million in funding, and that has leveraged private investment of $597 million.
Contributor John Hurdle takes a closer look at Delaware's downtown development districts. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also hear from Senator Tom Carper about a new highway bill that hopes to keep climate change in mind as it addresses the nation's roads and bridges. Plus more on efforts by Code Purple Kent County to address homelessness. And Enlighten Me, which tells the story of a Revolutionary War reunion at the Delaware Historical Society. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. About 2 weeks ago, the state of Delaware expanded its Downtown Development District program, which offers state incentives to projects that hold promise for revitalizing town centers. Capital projects in portions of four cities, Newcastle, Middletown, Clayton, and Delaware City, are now eligible for the program, which was initiated in 2015 under then-Governor Jack Markell. Wilmington, Dover, and Seaford were home to the initial downtown development districts. Smyrna, Milford, Harrington, Georgetown, and Laurel were added in 2016. Officials say this latest expansion comes in the wake of the program showing signs of having the desired impact in the downtown districts already established. What has that impact been? We asked contributor John Hurdle to delve into what's been accomplished so far in these cities that already have downtown development districts. He details what he discovered in his latest piece, available right now at DelawarePublic.org, and he joined me this week to tell us about it. For those who aren't familiar with the downtown development districts, tell us a little bit more about what they are and what do they offer to spur development in these areas in a series of towns across the state.
Well, essentially what this is a state rebate for up to 20% of the cost of purchasing properties, rehabbing properties, renovating properties which are in these so-called downtown development districts, and those are districts that are designated by the state as places that have the potential, have the need for a little bit of economic stimulus. And the idea is to encourage developers who might be a bit leery, who might not be totally convinced that they're going to get a good return on their investment, to as it were, push them across the line by providing a bit of public assistance.
And just as a point of clarification, when a town is designated a downtown development district, it's not the entirety of the town. It's a portion of their downtown area, correct?
That's correct.
Is the overarching theme in most of the places that have been designated thus far to create kind of the right blend of housing and business to allow these specific areas to take off where maybe they wouldn't otherwise?
Yes, that's right. And I think what they're really all aspiring to is this formula of live, work, play, which, of course, is many towns and cities are aspiring to these days. People, economic development authorities want to create places that are economically vibrant, and the way they want to do that is by creating town centers where people do more than work. In other words, they don't empty out at 5 o'clock when everybody goes home from the office. People stay there. People go to bars and restaurants, and most importantly, people will live there as well. So the idea is that people are more inclined to live in these town centers, and therefore help to stimulate the local economy.
So how do they decide what projects qualify for funding within these districts?
Well, there are three primary criteria here. One is they're evaluated on need, and that is gauged by things like looking at property prices, or if local real estate prices are struggling, then that would be one indication of need as far as the state is concerned. Another indication would be high commercial vacancy rates, for example. So that would be another sign that the local economy needed a little help. So that's one of the main criteria. Another one is that there would be a plan in place for businesses to invest. Typically, a city manager that is seeking inclusion in this DDD program would make the application on the basis that that a developer or developers would be interested in building specific projects, whether they be residential or commercial, but that they just are not quite ready to make that financial commitment without a little backing from the state. And then the third criterion here is for the local government to have some so-called skin in the game, and that is as a sign of the commitment by the local authority that they would be willing to do things like provide tax breaks for this new business that's proposed there, or maybe reduce their fees for utilities or something like that to as an indication of the local government's commitment to this project.
Overall, statewide, so what has been accomplished so far by this program?
Well, they've got some pretty big numbers associated with this. What they say is that in the 4 years that the program has been going so far, the state has provided $31.6 million in funding, and that it has leveraged private investment of $597 million. And that's over, there's been a total of 167 projects in eight cities, and with the latest announcement by Governor Carney in early August, there will be an additional four cities that qualify.
And these projects encompass a variety of commercial and residential efforts of varying sizes. I found an interesting one that you highlighted in your piece was actually a dental practice, which I'll admit surprised me a bit. How did it work in that case?
Well, this is a story about two brothers, both pretty young guys, aged 24 and 30. One of them is a business studies graduate of the University of Delaware, and the other is in fact a qualified dentist, and they wanted to set up a dental practice, and they found a building in downtown Smyrna that it was within Smyrna's downtown development district. And this building had been largely vacant for quite some time, and so they bought the building, and then they found that it needed significant renovation. It was going to be costing them a lot more than $200,000. It was only at that point that they discovered that because the building was in this Smyrna's DDD, that they were actually could qualify for $49,000 in state funding. And so speaking with one of the brothers, he said that that was actually crucial because that money allowed them to pay off a loan that unexpectedly got called in by one of their lenders in an early stage of this project. And he was quite candid about the fact that it was kind of what he called a rough start for this business, but they've come through that partly with the help of the state funding, and they've now got something like 2,000 patients and 13 employees, and so that appears to be quite a success story.
Fair to say though that Wilmington has seen the largest amount of activity under this program, and what does the program look like there in the state's largest city?
Well, yes. In fact, yes, the vast majority of the private funding has gone to Wilmington in this program, about $530 million. And that's been leveraged by around about $23 million in DDD funding. 34 projects in Wilmington have been completed, and there's another 34 in the pipeline, which means that funding has been reserved for them. But, of course, that funding won't be actually paid out by the state until those projects are completed, because it's based on the idea of a rebate.
And while we talk about the kind of that large amount of activity in Wilmington, I imagine the program, though, may have some more impactful projects in smaller cities and towns where maybe there are fewer projects, but they mean more. You mentioned the dental practice in Smyrna. Are there some examples of other success stories in smaller towns in Delaware that are under this DDD program that maybe don't happen without this program?
Well, indeed. There's one in Seaford. I was chatting with the director of the Delaware State Housing Authority, which oversees this program, and he told me about the project in Seaford, a 72-unit apartment complex, And the developer there kind of got cold feet about the idea at the last minute and allowed the permit to expire, but then found that there was actually the state money through the DDD was available to the tune of about $670,000. And so on that basis, revived the plans to build this this project, and half of which has now been built. So 36 of these units have been completed and are now fully occupied. And the developer is now moving forward with the second phase of that project. So I think it's fair to say that that's a good illustration of the stimulative effect that this funding can have.
You've talked a little bit about how much money has been leveraged by this program. I guess that's one way of looking at how well this program is doing. But are there other ways that the state's going to measure this program's success? I mean, we hear a lot of this kind of anecdotal success that you're describing in some of these stories. But, you know, how do they measure the impact on the towns overall at this point?
Well, what they're hoping to do eventually is to measure the impact in terms of economic metrics, things like jobs created or home values that are enhanced as a result of the increased economic activity that's brought about by these things. But what officials say, it's kind of too early days to be doing that, and so they're measuring the success of the program so far in terms of the amount of money that's been leveraged by this state funding. And as we said, it's more than $500 million so far. So you know they're claiming that as a pretty good indication that this is working.
Given that, is there room for this program to expand further beyond these additional cities that were announced just recently?
Well, the enabling legislation allows for a total of 15 cities, so three more is a possibility. But what officials tell me is that there won't be any decisions taken on any additions until the latest round of designees show that the funding is working well in these latest entrants.
Thanks to contributor John Hurdle for his time on The Green this week. John's piece on Delaware's downtown development districts is available right now at DelawarePublic.org. And stay with us. A conversation with Senator Tom Carper is up next. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Before Congress began its August recess, the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee unveiled the America's Transportation Infrastructure Act. Senator Tom Carper is the top Democrat on that committee and co-authored this bill, which is being touted by its supporters as the largest highway legislation in history. If passed, it would greenlight spending $287 billion over 5 years on efforts to maintain and repair the nation's roads and bridges, and more. Earlier this week, Senator Carper toured the state, highlighting what the bill could mean for Delaware, specifically the pieces that would target infrastructure vulnerable to climate change and sea level rise. And Delaware's senior senator also stopped by our Dover studio to discuss this bill and some other topics. The bill would invest about $1 billion in projects around the first state. And one area you've been highlighting is projects that would address roads that are vulnerable to climate change. How many of these projects are there around the state that could see action if this bill does wind up passing?
Overall, it's a $287 billion bill. And 90% of that bill will be – monies will be apportioned on a formula basis. Mm-hmm. The other billions of dollars will be apportioned to states. They can apply for grants. Mm-hmm. And like the most worthy projects, the most innovative, most creative, the projects that are best at addressing resiliency. Mm-hmm. What we want to do is encourage states to try some new approaches to making sure our roads, highways, bridges, especially in the day of this day and age with extreme weather, terrible weather, flooding weather. We're seeing a bunch of roads in Delaware today on our tour that in not just during the hurricane, not just during the nor'easter, but just maybe high tide and heavy rain, they're underwater. And not just once a year, but throughout the year.
I was going to say there are like a number of these kind of chronic hotspots in the first states that do see this on a regular basis. And all of them are ones that I guess frustrate people on a regular basis.
Well, there are. And we can... we can abandon those roads. And some places, I think Del Dot, a couple of places around the state where roads are underwater often, they've decided, it's getting worse, they've decided just to abandon those roads and help people find other alternatives. In some cases, the roads, we're going to look at a road down just outside of Lewis called New Road. Mm-hmm. New Road is oftentimes underwater. That's a road they're not going to abandon. They're going to try to find ways to raise the road, to build it higher, rebuild it higher.
And we have seen that work, even in this state, on other roads. The one that comes to my mind is Prime Hook Road, which Del Dot dealt with about 3 or so years ago. And it has not seen the same kind of chronic flooding that seemed regular before that work was done.
That was a combination, not just of building off the road. That was a combination of actually doing some interesting things with creating a place for water to go. Mm-hmm. And that's it's actually a very successful project in the National Wildlife Refuges. But that project is actually cited as an example, mm-hmm, of how to work with Mother Nature and to restore the passage of water through the through that National Wildlife Refuge in the ways that Mother Nature used to have it. And when we just kind of like dammed it up and created a situation where we had a lot of flooding. And it's actually works now as it ought to. It's a nice success story.
Is the goal with this, though, in looking at some of these roads that need this kind of assistance, is the idea to try and get to some of these, I guess for lack of a better term, you know, shovel-ready type of projects, ones that there are people are aware of, we know they're chronic, and they just need that attention sooner rather than later.
Mm-hmm. Save Delaware has a huge backlog on roads, highways, and bridges. Unfortunately, we have not only a huge backlog here for Delaware, yeah, in roads, highways, bridges, we have about a $780 billion backlog across the country in work that needs to be done. And there's just an unwillingness on the part of the Congress, and in some cases this administration, previous administrations, to actually pay for things that we know we need. Mm-hmm. We know we need to invest more money in our roads, highways, bridges. There's just a reluctance to do that. And I've been one who said that historically we've paid for, at the state level and the federal level, for service transportation projects, roads, highways, bridges. We paid for it through user fees. The traditional user fee has been gas and diesel taxes, but there are others as well. I just bought a new car for my wife on her birthday this summer, and we had to pay a document fee, which was a couple of $1,000, as I recall. Mm-hmm. And for a state that has no sales tax, we do have an auto document fee that we use. It's one of the ways we generate monies for our roads, highways, bridges. But there's just not enough money. And we're seeing an introduction of vehicles now, some, but a lot more later, electric-powered vehicles. They don't use any gas or diesel. Hydrogen-powered vehicles, they don't use any gas or diesel fuel. So the question is we have more and more electric and, you know, fuel cell-powered vehicles with hydrogen on the roads. How are we going to pay for our roads, highways, and bridges? And one of the beauties of our legislation is the idea of preparing for the day when we have fewer and fewer diesel and gasoline-powered vehicles on the road, and because we still are going to need to maintain the roads. And the idea is to move toward a vehicle miles traveled approach, mm-hmm, called VMT. There's about 6 or 7 states across the country that are now in a pilot project. Delaware is one of those,
yep,
states. And eventually we're going to increase the number of states where they're trying this out, so that at the end of the day, folks that are driving electric vehicle or hydrogen-powered vehicle, fuel cell vehicle, they're going to pay their fair share as well.
I was curious because, I mean, this kind of emphasis on resiliency, climate change as being part of a highway bill is a bit different. And I'm curious, is in some ways this an effort to kind of get toward a Green New Deal type of atmosphere, but do so with a smaller bite of the apple?
Yeah. When the new Congress was seated on January 3rd this year, and there were some new folks in the progressive wing of the Democratic Party were in the House, and they were pushing hard something called the Green New Deal.
Yeah.
And I was asked, was this something I was endorsing? I said, I want to help write the Green New Deal.
Mm-hmm.
And part of doing that is the legislation that is a traditional 5-year highway transportation bill. But we're including that in provisions there that actually will, as we build out the new generation of roads, highways, bridges, we're going to do so in a way that will reduce the incidence of sea level rise and the incidence of climate change and global warming. And that would be a good thing. The other thing is, it used to be that a primary source of carbon emissions in the air, which lead to global warming, climate change, extreme weather. But the primary source used to be, for many years, was coal-fired utility plants. We got, until not that long ago, 40% of our electricity was from coal-fired utility plants. They put a lot of carbon dioxide into the air. We have more carbon dioxide, higher levels of CO2 in the air right now than we've ever had, ever. We've been able to go back and measure like hundreds of thousands of years back in time, and this is the highest it's ever been. There used to be a guy named Willie Sutton, who was a bank robber during the Great Depression. People would say that they finally caught him and had him before the judge at his trial. The judge said to him, "Mr. Sutton, why do you rob banks?" And he says, "That's where the money is." And one of the reasons why we focus on reducing emissions, fuel emissions, carbon emissions, other emissions from cars, trucks, and vans is that's the highest source of carbon emissions that we have. So we have to work there first. And while we're working on this transportation bill, this highway bill, I'm also working to try to get about 15 automakers and 50 states to agree on fuel efficiency standards to reduce emissions of, among other things, carbon dioxide, so that we're not just facing, you know, addressing the symptoms of the problems, we're actually going to go after the root causes and to do both at the same time.
Yeah, so you're mentioning vehicles. I wanted to kind of get into this a little bit as well. There's money in this bill for electric vehicle and alternative vehicle charging stations. And I'm curious about this because EVs do seem like such a chicken-egg proposition, right? I mean, we did some reporting recently that indicated that, that Delaware, between the public and private charging stations that are available, now has addressed kind of the idea of range anxiety. You can go around the state, and if you need a charging station, there should be one that's reasonably close to you. But we also found that some of the private folks who have them, the Royal Farms, for example, that have them at their stores, say they're not getting a whole lot of use. And some people are suggesting, well, the key is actually to get more people to invest in buying these cars, mm-hmm. And perhaps look at things like vehicle-to-grid technology that might show people that, hey, if you have an electric car at your home and you have this technology, it's also helping you with, you know, dealing with your electric at home. It's not just your car. And I'm curious how you see that balance of, you know, which comes first? Do we need more charging stations to get people to buy more electric vehicles, or do we need to get more people to buy electric vehicles to need the charging stations to actually, you know, be used?
Great question. I was on the phone last week with a woman named Mary Barra. She's the CEO of General Motors. Hmm. And I was talking to her about whether or not General Motors might want to join a number of other auto companies in a 50-state agreement on with California and 49 other states, including Delaware, on reducing auto emissions, fuel efficiency, improving fuel efficiency standards. And she said to me, she said, you know, here at General Motors, we've worked for years. She's been there for many years. She said, we've worked for years to reduce emissions, harmful emissions, including carbon dioxide, from our cars, trucks, and vans, working on the internal combustion engine. She said, we've gotten just about all the improvements out of it that we can get. Mm-hmm. And in terms of reducing emissions, for improving performance, she said, there's just not much more to get. And she said, the future is electric. And she said, that's what we're betting on. And that's where we're going. And she said, we've done a lot of surveying among our customers across the country and asking what are their concerns. And she said, among the concerns are one, price, initial mm-hmm. price. And it's important that continue at least for a while, the tax credit that people get when they buy an electric vehicle. So the other thing is that range anxiety. Mm-hmm. She said, 300 miles seems to be like the magic number for people, for most people. And I know for myself, when oftentimes I take the train to Washington tomorrow, I'll go to Washington and we'll start off the day in Wilmington, go to Smyrna, have a kickoff from school and big celebration, welcome back to school at Smyrna School District, and then we'll drive over to Washington, D.C., and then back up. It's about 250 miles, roughly, about 250-mile drive tomorrow. And there aren't many electric-powered vehicles that will get that for you. But she said, we're getting better. We're getting better to this. And I think we're getting to the place where there was range anxiety concerns are going to go away. And she says what we need now is to make sure that they're even more, especially when people travel outside of their neighborhoods or outside mm-hmm. of their towns or communities, that they know as they travel across the state or across the country, they'll be able to get not just find a place to get their a battery charged, but get it charged quickly, speedily, right. So they're not wasting a lot of time.
Fair enough. I do want to hit a couple other things off topic before we let you go. One is the trade war with China. How concerned are you with the direction it's taken over the past week or so and the tenor of President Trump's approach to this.
The president, I watched a little bit on television. I saw the president, and maybe he was getting ready to go on his G7 trip. And he said, no president, no other president ever did anything out to take the Chinese on. They were bad actors. They tried to steal our secrets, and they wouldn't let us sell our products to them. And they tried to, you know, put a whole lot of pour their products into our markets. We wouldn't do anything for years. Actually, the last administration negotiated a 14-nation deal on the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Together we were like 40% of the world trading bloc in this hemisphere, Canada all the way down to Chile, and over in Asia as well. The one country that was not included was China, because they're a bad actor and they don't play by the rules. And so you'd think that a new administration would come in and embrace the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which excludes China, punishes them for their bad behavior, and allows us to be part of a 14-nation trading bloc that will strengthen us many ways in our economy. And this administration, the Trump administration, pulled us out of it. Makes no sense. It was one of the smartest things that the Obama administration did, and we walked away from it, which is crazy. Now we're in this trade tariff war with China. It creates great uncertainty for our businesses. Businesses need certainty and predictability. And we're seeing turmoil in the markets, the turmoil in the marketplace. And this is not what we need. It's not what the president needs. He's getting bad advice. And he got really bad advice in pulling out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And if it's frankly, unfortunately, it's like Humpty Dumpty. Now, you know, we've broken the eggs. How do you recreate it? We really screwed up and lost a great opportunity.
And the other thing I wanted to ask you about was gun legislation in the wake of the recent mass shootings. Been a lot of discussion about that. How optimistic are you when Congress gets back to work? Something, whether it be red flags, background checks, something would be moving forward on Capitol Hill.
The idea of having not selling, allowing people to have access who are unstable, mentally unstable, who have a tradition or history of violence, including gun violence, that they could get access to guns over the internet or at a gun show or something like that. And we've got to be smarter than that. The president is sort of hot and cold on this. And some days he's for stronger background checks, other days he's not. Depends on who he's talked to last. Most people in this country think that we ought to strengthen our background checks. Still be respectful of the Second Amendment, and we can do both, and we ought to do both.
Thanks to Senator Tom Carper for joining us on The Green this week. And The Green continues in just a moment with more on an effort by new leadership at Code Purple Kent County to engage the public on the issue of homelessness. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. New leadership took the helm at Code Purple Kent County this summer. The organization's founder, Rebecca Martin, stepped down and handed the reins to Ennio Emanuel and Dr. Maribel Zaragoza, who are now serving as co-directors. Emanuel and Dr. Zaragoza plan to hold a public meeting to discuss homelessness in Kent County and what Code Purple Kent County needs to do to address it. And Emanuel recently spoke to Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele about it.
Talk about why public involvement is so important in Code Purple Kent County.
So Code Purple Kent County is all right now volunteer-based. Everything that we do, we give right, you know, everything that we get or do is all for the community. So by doing that, we do need help, you know, with people being able to volunteer at night or going or, you know, bringing food with the homeless people that are staying in our sanctuaries. Also, you know, we need to connect with different sanctuaries, different churches, nonprofits that have space that would like to volunteer with us to be able to put the homeless people during the cold nights. And also people who just have creative ideas. If you're good at a life skill or some type of business skill that you could help our people with, if you're part of a state agency and you would like to connect with some of our participants to be able to meet your agency's goals when it comes to solving homelessness or, you know, the epidemic when it comes to drug abuse, alcohol abuse, all those things, you know, all those different agencies, nonprofits, volunteers, they will all find a place to be used at, you know, at our meeting. We'll tell you how to be involved and how you can get, you know, get your community involved and your neighborhood involved and your school clubs, your social clubs, because we want this to, you know, this affects our community directly. So we want to, you know, grow on that with everyone together, not just us bringing the ideas to you. We want everyone to create the ideas together.
Ennio, last time you and I spoke, we spoke about the fact that Code Purple, when it started, it was basically to get the homeless in out of the cold and open up these sanctuaries during the winter months. But you and I spoke, and one of the questions I believe I asked you then was, what happens to the homeless in the extreme heat? So now one of the things I think you're trying to do is open up these cooling stations so that the homeless have a place to go in the extreme heat.
Yes, we opened up 6 cooling stations in partnership with Kent County Levy Corps. They opened up the 3 libraries in Kent County. There was none really downtown because they're all either in Woodside, Harrington, or Smyrna, the libraries. So I partnered with the commissioners. I talked with Alan Angel and Eric Bluxo, and my Dr. Maribel and I, we decided with our team that it was important to open up some cooling stations. And, it was a need in the community. A lot of people brought it to our attention as well. And so we put, cold water and air conditioning spots here in Dover. We opened one over by Rodney Village at 1550 South Governors, 1447 South Governors in Dover, as well as at our office at 1207 East Division Street in Dover. And we also partnered Hopes and Dreams. They only are able to help out with adults, but Hopes and Dreams is a mental health peer support center, and they accept people, all day long, all the public. They don't check your IDs even because of this, the severity of the conversations they have in their peer groups. But they also do yoga, art classes, computer classes all day long at the Hopes and Dreams Center, and they're open daily as well with water and air conditioning. They're over at 521 West Division Street. We've opened up those 6 spots in Kent County because, it's very hot. There's people that are, overheating. A lot of elderly are not able. Sometimes they don't have AC units, and they're just dealing with fans. So we've been responding not only with cooling stations. We've been reaching out to people who don't have AC units, who need fans. We've been giving away fans. I've given away AC units, actually, that I've received. And so we've been trying to do our best to mobilize and solve that issue. But we do expect, next year to be on top of it and be able to work with volunteers to get the cooling stations out quicker, because Kent County was one of the last counties to move on that.
Talk about what you feel the number one challenge is facing the homeless population right now in Kent County.
I think the number one issue is acceptance. I think a lot of people in our community here in Delaware, I grew up in Delaware since I was a kid, and I'm a Latino, but I have friends from all different backgrounds. And I think the biggest thing that we're dealing with in Kent County is just an epidemic of not accepting people who are not like them. And so I think we have to understand that, Delaware, number one, I work with politicians and government officials all the time. And so I try to not only meet the needs of the social world when it comes to churches and different nonprofits, but I also try to stay in line with where our government is going, our governor, our lieutenant governor, and the rest of all the administration in our state. Because if we're not all in one mind, if we're not all working together, then everyone is going to be doing different things all the time, and no one's going to know what each other is doing. And so I think for me, it's just everyone realizing that, we need to accept the homeless, we need to love them, we need to take care of them, because one day it could be any of us. And so I love on people because if one day I might need someone to love on me or to love my family. And I think if we all have that mindset, not thinking of people by their culture or by where they're from, or maybe they're not even from Delaware and they're homeless here and people get irritated because people just show up here. I think to put yourself in their shoes, because you one day could be in their shoes, if we all just revolve with that mindset, we'll really be able to move forward together. And then just communication. I think communication, and I'm getting a lot of communication from people. I'm blessed right now. And you see me online. I'm really big on social media. I actually manage other social media pages too. I manage about 22 pages right now. So I am big on social media, but one of the reasons why I'm always online or connected or on the phone with people is because I want communication to be very evident through Code Purple and with the people that we work with, because there's so many organizations working with human trafficking to fight that. There's nonprofits working with reentry, and when people are coming out of correctional facilities and they're homeless, there is what we do with the homeless. There is organizations working with sex offenders and all of these different groups. if nobody works with them and does what they need to do to help the people, they're just going to be out in the cold alone, no one helping them there. And so also, while all of us are mobilizing on our social end, the politicians and the government agencies and the Department of Health, they're mobilizing on their end. And so if we learn to work together, we're going to be able to use funding easier and be able to be smarter with our money, and we'll be able to see the fruits of our labor.
Ennio, if somebody walked up to you and said, Ennio, how do we end homelessness in Kent County, what would your first answer be?
My first answer would be that people should open up their houses. I think, you know, we have to think outside the box, and we have to, if we have to be more open. I think we have to be more open. There's space everywhere. There's people who care. And I think we have to think about the space that's open, that's not being used. That would be my first answer. How can we use space that's not being used legally without causing issues? You know, that'd be my first answer. But then there's a lot of logistics that come after that. And so, you know, just like Airbnb, you can rent out your house for money. I think that should be a possibility for people to do for no money. I think if I like people to use, if I don't mind people in my backyard, I should be able to Airbnb my backyard for someone to stay in a tent and for a night, you know, not like permanent, just for a night. And I think something like that worldwide would be the answer to homelessness temporarily. And then you just partner that up with social work and casework, where people are getting referred to a, you know, housing stabilization at the Department of Health and Social Services, or they're being referred to the Community Support Unit, which is another unit that the Department of Health and Social Services recently launched. And I think if you are able to help people with the filling space and partner with casework and social work, that's going to be the answer. But the issue is that there's no space. And so I think we just need, there's a lot of people out there maybe listening right now that have a sanctuary with space they're not using, or RVs that they're not using, or even tents that they're not using. This year we ran out of tents. You know, we got, you know, 100 tents from Firefly, and we've given them all out, which means that there's homeless people living in tents around the city, around the state. But when, you know, I have friends and I have different acquaintances that have different properties or churches that are not being utilized to the best of their ability. And I think if we just all realize, if I see a space and it's not being used for 6 months at a time, why not use it to help the homeless if we can give you all the volunteers and the means and the things that you need to get the work done? But if they don't open up their space, I think that's when different innovations, like I was mentioning earlier, like an app similar to Airbnb or something like that, is going to end up coming forward, because homelessness is not going away. And so I think, you know, if you see space that you're not using, work with us to let us be able to use it, and we can tell you how that's possible. If you have any questions, they can call us or write us on social media. We want to help the community grow, make Delaware better, and end homelessness and end hunger.
All right, you want to end hunger and homelessness, and so you're having this public meeting. Give everybody the day, date, and time and location, and your last pitch for people to attend this meeting.
All right, so Copra with Kent County will be meeting at the Christ Episcopalian Church in Dover, Delaware, at 524 South State Street in Dover, Delaware. And it's going to be, their parking is in the back of their building, and it's going to be in their meeting hall. And this is going to be a great opportunity for anyone who wants to know a little bit more about Code Purple, who's ever been interested in helping to fight against homelessness, joblessness, and hunger in their own city. You know, not somewhere else. We're dealing with people in our own city. If you ever have wanted to help out with that, or be a part of that, be a part of something greater than what either I or anyone can fathom, just join us at 5:30 on September 9th there at Christ Church in Dover, and we'll welcome you with open arms and get you involved.
Thanks to Code Purple Kent County Co-Director Ennio Emanuel for joining us on The Green this week. And The Green concludes next with Enlighten Me and a trip back to the Revolutionary War. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. A Revolutionary War era flag from the First State and the man who captured it are having a reunion of sorts. The flag is a Delaware militia flag that's in the Delaware Historical Society's collection. The man is William Danzy, a British Army officer who captured that flag 242 years ago in September 1777 during fighting in the area shortly before the Battle of Brandywine. Now, Danzy is obviously not showing up in person, but his portrait, on loan from the Duke of Wellington's Regiment Museum in Halifax, England, is here, making its first ever appearance in the United States. The two are on display together at the Delaware History Museum in Wilmington until September 7th, before heading to Philadelphia's Museum of the American Revolution to be part of its Cost of Revolution, the Life and Death of an Irish Officer exhibition that opens September 28th and runs through March. For this week's Enlighten Me, we sat down with Delaware Historical Society Chief Curator Lee Reifenberg to discuss this unique pairing.
What is this Revolutionary War era flag's backstory? And how did it wind up in the hands of William Danzy when all was said and done?
So it's a really interesting backstory in the sense that it was a Delaware militia flag created for a regiment that was camped down near the Christiana Bridge. But they didn't get to use it for very long because sometime during the week between the Battle of Cooch's Bridge and the Battle of Brandywine, William Danzy, who was a member, he was an officer in the British Light Infantry, came along and was somehow able to capture the flag from the Delaware militia colonel. He captured a few other things as well, but it was the flag that he really prized, and he writes in his letters that he was going to take it home as a war trophy, so he did take it home with him to England. The interesting sort of postscript to the story is that 150 years later, the Danzy family had really treasured the flag for a very long time, but eventually they decided to put it up at public auction. Somehow this news filtered back to the folks in Delaware, and especially the Delaware Historical Society. And so they set up a sort of public subscription donation program for people to contribute money to buy the flag. So crowdsourcing was alive and well. This was 1927. And they were able to do that, but they had a certain amount of competition because back across the ocean, William Danzy's original regiment, the 33rd Regiment of Foot, was also making plans to purchase the flag. So there was some competition at auction. But the Delaware Historical Society was victorious, and the people of Delaware were once again able to reclaim the flag. And so in a sense, it was Delaware's only Revolutionary War era victory, just 150 years too late.
And just to clarify for people, so this was captured sometime in that span between Cooch's Bridge and the Battle of Brandywine, as it was kind of the greater Philadelphia campaign during the Revolutionary War.
Exactly. It's the timing of all of this is really interesting in that this is the time when the Delaware and Pennsylvania campaigns really start to heat up. So this is the time when we start to commemorate certainly the engagement at Cooch's Bridge and Brandywine and Germantown. So this was a time when Danzy was particularly active, getting ready to join Howell's army and head up to the campaign north. But whatever was happening during that week, he was engaged in some skirmishes, and somehow he managed to engage with the Delaware colonel, and he was able to capture the flag.
Tell us a little bit about the portrait itself and how, I guess, it came to be known that this portrait existed to even pair with this flag.
So for the Delaware Historical Society, having Danzy's flag is certainly significant enough. Having the letters that describe his capture of the flag is incredible because it provides an incredible level of context. But there was a third piece of this collection that had been previously unknown. Danzy had commissioned a portrait of himself sometime around 1780 when he returned from the war. And everyone had lost track of where the portrait was located. And somehow, the Museum of the American Revolution and their curatorial staff were able to track it down. And it turns out it's been all of these years in a small regimental museum in Yorkshire in the United Kingdom. And they were very willing to lend it to us as part of an exhibit that the Museum of the American Revolution is launching in September called The Cost of Revolution, The Life and Death of an Irish Soldier. So it became this really sort of serendipitous thing where we were able to bring the portrait and the letters and the flag together at one time, and they're now being displayed in the Delaware History Museum for the first time on Delaware soil.
So what is the significance in your mind of kind of connecting these dots, the flag, with the letters, with the portrait, and having them kind of all in one place for people to kind of experience as, you mentioned, kind of a package?
We've called this a revolutionary reunion, and that's, in fact, exactly what it is. And, you know, each of these pieces of Delaware history and of William Danzy are significant on their own. But bringing them together is really incredible. The flag is certainly Danzy, in a roundabout way, through his actions and the capture of this flag, contributed to one of the Delaware Historical Society's marquee collections. It's something that we've treasured all of these years. But there was always this sort of missing piece. Up to this point, our curatorial staff has only known Danzy through his letters and the rudimentary documentation that we had about the flag itself. But finally getting to meet him, as it were, through the unveiling of the portrait has been a really remarkable thing. We know that Danzy will serve as a more minor figure in this exhibit that's coming up. He did serve with the gentleman who is the focus of the exhibition in the British Light Infantry. But having these things together, where Danzy is really a central figure, having them together here in Delaware is something that's pretty remarkable.
And you mentioned to me earlier, as we were going over to take a look at the flag and the portrait itself, that this was an opportunity for you to get some more work done on the flag. Tell people a little bit about that and exactly what was done to kind of help preserve this flag a little bit better.
This has been a really remarkable collaboration between the Delaware Historical Society and the Museum of the American Revolution, and it occurred to us once we agreed to this loan that if you have a 240-something-year-old flag and you're going to have it displayed on a much larger stage for a much broader audience to engage with, you'd better make sure that it's show-ready. And that involved for us a certain amount of conservation on the flag itself. The Danzy flag was last conserved in 2006 by a wonderful textile conservator named Virginia Whelan, who incidentally had done all of the textile conservation, including Washington's tent at the Museum of the American Revolution. But this was an opportunity to get back in touch with her, and she was able to do the conservation work this time over the summer as well. So it was a real source of relief to be able to turn over something that's so precious to us to someone who was already familiar with it and able to do the work. So she was able to take the flag out of its mount. I was able to see the flag sort of exposed for the first time, which was incredible. It's one of 12 regimental flags known to exist today, but what makes this one so unique is the fact that it's in such remarkable condition. The fact that both the cords and the tassels are still intact and connected is really remarkable. But one of the first things that Virginia did, the conservator did when she worked on the flag, was to tell us that everything she was doing was going to be reversible. And that's incredibly important in textile conservation, because as the science advances and as technology and methodologies and best practices change, you really need to be able to go back and undo your work if necessary. So everything that's been done on this flag can be changed in the future if it needs to be. And we know that this isn't the final time that the flag will be conserved, because conservation is not a one-and-done sort of proposition. It's something that you need to go back and tweak periodically. But to be able to have this conservation work done here in the Delaware History Museum was a really wonderful thing, and we know that we're going to send it to its temporary home in Philadelphia in the best possible condition and ready to go.
And I imagine that there are many people who are not really aware that some of these pieces from the Revolutionary War era are really around, and they are things that you can see and connect with in person. Is this an opportunity, you think, to kind of just remind people that there are these things, both here in Delaware and elsewhere, that can take you back to that place and time?
Absolutely. And what's so wonderful about this is you can see these things online, you can look at pictures, you can read about them in books, but there is a certain just visceral reaction that takes place when you see the items in person. And that's how we all felt when we finally saw the flag and the letters and the portrait together. There's just something amazing about being able to come into a space and engage with those items on a very personal level.
You are working, obviously, with the Museum of the American Revolution on this project, loaning the flag to them for their longer-term exhibit that's coming up through the winter into the spring. It seems like it's a natural fit to work with them. Is there hope that there'll be additional ways to collaborate with them in the future around these type of things?
I certainly hope so. I think one of the really sort of core tenets of good collection stewardship is that if you have a collection that's unique and worth sharing, you should do whatever you can to make it possible to facilitate a loan and ensure that it's able to be discovered by a broader audience. And that's a part of what we've done here.
Thanks to the Delaware Historical Society's chief curator, Lee Reifenberg, for enlightening us this week. The Revolutionary War era Delaware militia flag and William Danzy portrait can be seen at the Delaware History Museum in Wilmington Wednesday through Saturday, 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. through September 7th. And that's it for this week's edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website, on Apple Podcasts, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, contributor John Hurdle, and Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Byrne saying thanks for joining us, and we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.